Well, good morning. Again, I'm Doug, if we haven't met before. And we are looking at this ancient biblical case study in the month of January. We've been talking about the last couple of weeks. And in case you haven't been here, and even if you have, I want to just catch you up on what we've covered so far and what we're going to talk about today. So this is the case study of Naaman from 2 Kings. And so week one, we learned about Naaman. He's this general. Very wealthy, successful, had the ear of the king, and yet he came down with what was at the time an incurable disease called leprosy. And none of the best doctors and all of his wealth couldn't actually buy him a cure. But he had a foreign servant girl in his household, and he showed her respectful curiosity. When she herself had empathy for him, and instead of her being resentful of his high position and his status, she empathized, commiserated with his pain, suggested he go visit a prophet in Israel. And then he himself showed that respectful curiosity back to her, didn't just dismiss her as being a foreign, lower class individual. And so empathy started him on this new journey. And so then he does. He takes all of his wealth. He goes to this prophet of God in Israel, a man named Elisha. And Elisha miraculously heals him of leprosy, like that, instantly. And Naaman, being a good guy, tries to then reward Elisha for that, offers him a lifetime's worth of wealth, 750 pounds of silver, gold, fine clothing, all these great things. But Elisha modeled self-control. See, he had this God of grace that he wanted Naaman to get to know, a God who's not for sale, a God who blesses us not because of how much we give, but just because he loves us. See, Elisha had a bigger yes than simply material goods or well-being. That's what allowed him to have self-control. And if this were just your basic Aesop's fable or fairy tale, I mean, we've already got enough lessons out of this story, right? There's been a miraculous healing. Everyone goes away happy. End of discussion. That's not the end of the story. The story actually now has some twists and turns, and that's why we're going to spend the next 3 weeks looking at some of the things that happen next. And so with that in mind, let's see what happens next. Naaman has been healed of leprosy, and he's gone back to his homeland, hasn't had to pay a dime for this miracle, this healing from God. All right? And now Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said to himself, "My master was too easy on Naaman, this Aramean, by not accepting from him what he brought. As surely as the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him." So Gehazi hurried after Naaman. And when Naaman saw him running toward him, he got down from the chariot to meet him. "Is everything all right?" he asked. "Everything is all right," Gehazi answered. "My master sent me to say, 2 young men from the company of the prophets have just come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver, 75 pounds of silver, and 2 sets of clothing." "By all means, take 2 talents, said Naaman. And he urged Gehazi to accept them. And then he tied up the 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 sets of clothing. And he gave them to 2 of his servants, and they carried them ahead of Gehazi. And when Gehazi came to the hill, he took the things from the servants and put them away in the house. And then he sent the men away, and they left. And when he went in and stood before his master, Elisha asked him, 'Where have you been, Gehazi?' 'Your servant didn't go anywhere,' Gehazi answered. But Elisha said to him, 'Was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you? Is this the time to take money, or to accept clothes, or olive groves and vineyards, or flocks and herds, or male and female slaves? Naaman's leprosy will cling to you and to your descendants forever.' And then Gehazi went from Elisha's presence, and his skin was leprous. It had become as white as snow." Whoa! Didn't see that ending coming, did ya? The pagan guy that conquers God's people, he gets miraculously healed. The faithful church worker, he ends up cursed with leprosy. It's a real twist. And yet, probably it seems fair to most of us, right? Because, I mean, just looking at the story, what obvious virtue was Gehazi lacking? It was on the video clip before I even talked. Anyone remember it? There it is. right? So here we go. This brings us to this week as we talk about this concept of integrity. Gehazi was lacking integrity. And that's also coincidentally one of these five success skills that Thomas Hoare and others have called out as necessary for us to truly navigate this life successfully. So let's talk about this morning, but let's really talk about it. And what I mean by that is not just with, we festoon these words with all of these connotations and background and things that we've learned or been even hurt by with some of these things, but let's really look carefully at integrity, why it's so important, why it's so difficult to have. And maybe the first point to say is that none of these virtues are explicitly Christian virtues. And I think that's important to note because I actually have friends and people in my life that are believers, and I have people that are not believers, and yet they still can have these virtues. They're not exclusive to our faith. I think most people would recognize the value of these things. What I would say is that I think being someone who believes in and knows this God of grace, I think actually helps us have these virtues in a more healing way. And we'll talk more about that throughout this. But to just really say that this is so important, this concept of integrity, that we've got to really talk about it in a thoughtful way, not just in a moralizing, lecturing kind of a way. And I'll give you an example of what I mean and why I think this is so important. Do any of you remember about 25 years ago, there was a ministry that kind of came to prominence in our country called Promise Keepers? Anyone remember Promise Keepers? All right, and if you remember them or if you don't know what they are, their big mission was they believed that we needed to have men of integrity. In fact, this is what their website says right now. Like, if you go to their website right now, this is what they're about. This is what they do. And their story is pretty amazing. Out of nowhere, this coach in Colorado starts having this message about being men of integrity. And within like a year or two, suddenly they're selling out stadiums all across the country. Men are just packing in to hear this message. And in fact, they had a march on Washington. 800,000 men marched on Washington, D.C. in the name of Promise Keepers being men of integrity. Pretty cool. But then, just as unexpectedly and just as dramatically, Promise Keepers kind of just dropped off the face of the earth. They went from packing in stadiums in every city, marching on Washington, you know, millions of men being reached, and then they just kind of died out. And if you look now, no one really knows why. You look at the experts, you even ask Promise Keepers leaders themselves, and they'll come up with some guesses. I actually think I might know why. And it's because I went and looked at the website this week, and I looked at all of the seven promises that a promise keeper is supposed to keep. And as I read through the list of things that men of integrity are supposed to do, I had one thought and one thought only. I can't do any of this. It's too much. It's overwhelming. You have all of these things. You're supposed to be a good husband and a good worker and a good boss and a good churchgoer and a good parent and all these things. And then on top of that, you're supposed to be, you know, the sixth promise that you're an ambassador of racial reconciliation on top of everything else. And I'm like, don't you get a weekend off? I got to be a good husband, parent, worker, and I got to fix racial problems in this country. Like, it's too many things. And what I suspect is that people flocked to the banner of integrity because they felt the need that this is truly something that we need in this country, that we need at a personal level, but that little by little, as they tried to live up to this standard of integrity, they couldn't. And every time they failed at something where they weren't the perfect husband or they weren't the good parent or they forgot to fight for racial reconciliation one day, a little bit more shame crept in. A little bit more fear, a little bit more overwhelmedness, and people just kind of quietly started stepping back and saying, well, if I can't do it, why should I be attending rallies and telling other people they should do it? Right? This topic is too important for me to stand up here with some slogans and some platitudes about, hey, here's how you have integrity. Stop lying and just get your life right. It's what Promise Keepers did. And as a result, they're a shell of their former selves. They're not doing anything today. And so let's really look at this. Speaking of these platitudes, like here's one platitude that I have always heard my entire life growing up. I've heard one main definition of integrity. Maybe you've heard it too. Integrity is doing the right thing when no one is looking. And if that's helpful for remembering the definition of integrity, then great. I don't want to take that away from anyone. But what I'll say is this. This has been virtually useless to me as far as actually making choices of integrity in my life. Like, this has not actually been a helpful saying as I strive to be a man of integrity for a couple of reasons. The first one is the older I get, the less I have the illusion that I ever know the right thing in a given situation. You know, elementary school ethics, you know, where everything is black and white and there's good guys and there's bad guys, you just start to realize it's just not true to life. And that more and more as I'm faced with the actual things that are plaguing myself or the families in this community, the right thing is never that clear. I'll have couples in for marriage counseling and they've been suffering from years of chronic abuse. And they're asking me, what should we do? And outside of the obvious, well, you need to stop abusing each other, or one of you needs to stop abusing the other. And they're like, well, we've tried. And they say to me, well, God hates divorce, doesn't he? And I say, well, yeah, but he hates abuse too. I don't know what to tell that couple. I don't know what the right thing is for them. If they get divorced, they're breaking the sixth commandment. If they don't get divorced, they're breaking the fifth commandment. Either way, I have no way of telling them the right thing. Or even my daughter has struggled over the years with being picked on at school. And in that moment where someone is you know, shoving her or picking on her, you know, physically, you know, what should she do? Should she turn the other cheek? Or should she clock him? Right? And I'll tell you this, in my own household, Mia, who you just met a second ago, we disagree about what the right thing to do for my daughter in that situation is. I won't tell you which one is on which side. I'll just say one of us thinks that she should try to kill him with kindness, and the other one thinks that she should punch him into next week. And you could probably make a biblical case for either of those, but either way, it's not really clear what the right thing is. Or one that's really been getting me lately is I have to turn left onto Manchester every day for work. And occasionally, it's always awful, but occasionally there is a very kind person who is already on Manchester trying to turn left onto my street. And they see me and they see my plight and they stop way back and they gesture for me to go. And I'm so grateful for the politeness and the kind gesture that's such a rare thing in traffic these days. But I'm also like, you're violating the rules of right of way. You've got the right of way. You need to go. And so they're gesturing at me to go. And I'm like, I don't really want to go. That's actually not what the law says. And in the meantime, the cars are backing up behind them. And then they start honking because that person's not going. And I'm like, I don't know the right thing to do here. Right? There are very few moments, you know, besides these obvious things like don't litter, you know, don't call somebody names. There are very few moments that actually have a clear-cut right thing, even if you've got biblical morality. But even more than that, what I've come to realize too is I've never actually experienced a moment where no one is looking. Right? It's kind of a myth, this idea that no one's looking. First of all, in this connected age, someone's always looking. Or even when you look at the high-profile lapses of integrity against leaders, both business or political leaders or religious leaders, the lapse of integrity isn't when no one's looking, it's when everyone's looking. It's when someone makes a credible accusation against this leader and everyone's watching them saying, well, how are you going to respond? And they get up there and they say, nope, I absolutely did not do that thing. And then they investigate and find out, yep, you absolutely did do that thing. The lapse of integrity wasn't when no one's looking. It was when the eyes of the world were on them and the fear of consequences were too great that they lapsed in integrity. And even more than that, I'll say this, even in these rare moments where there truly is no one around, where it's just you and whatever situation you find yourself in, then that means you know who's already looking in that moment? I am. I'm looking at myself. I'm noticing what I do or what I don't do. And even if there's no one else around to judge or condemn me, I'm sure around to judge and condemn myself. And so that's why this has never actually worked for me. But in fact, that last point has been the key to my unlocking a way out of this swamp of trying to figure out what integrity actually looks like and how we're called to live it. And I discovered it through this one book. I read a lot of books. I don't recommend most books that I read to most people. I recommend this book to everyone. There is no one in any walk of life, season, gender, vocation, anything that would not absolutely have their lives transformed by reading this book, Leadership and Self-Deception. And I want to give you just one example from the book this morning, because it's the example that opened the door to a new way to understand integrity and to actually change my life in a meaningful way, not just to be shamed by some ministry because I didn't have integrity the way they thought I should. See, and their main point is this, is that integrity breaks down long before that person has the press conference where they have to confess to something or not. Long before that, integrity had broken down through a series of small little steps that you and I take every single day. And it starts with this moment that they call self-betrayal. This moment where something happens and you act in a way that you feel you shouldn't have acted. Okay? So, and this is important. This is critical to me. This is not in a way that the Bible says you shouldn't have acted. It's not in a way that your boss says you shouldn't have acted or your spouse. It's a way that you personally feel you shouldn't have acted. And that you've betrayed not your morals, not your boss, not your partner, not your kids. You've betrayed, first and foremost, yourself. All right, and there's an example they give, and it's one that resonated with me, so I'm going to share it with you because I think it's a fairly universal condition. This example of this moment, if any of you have ever had kids, and your little baby's in the other room, and it's middle of the night, and you're sound asleep, and the baby starts crying, and you wake up, and you have this urge in that moment, this, you know, the first thing, oh, I need to go comfort the baby. That's your urge. It's just natural. It's innate as a parent. You just think, oh, I need to help my baby. But then you have a second thought, which is, I've got a spouse over there, and they could comfort the baby. And so then what you do is you pretend you're still asleep. And you just play this game of chicken. Which one of us can last through the baby crying longer? And here's their point, I think it's a good one. In that moment, your spouse hasn't asked anything of you. There's not any biblical commandment, you know, 11th commandment, thou shalt not let your baby cry, right? You're not violating religion. But what you are violating is you had this urge to do a good thing for your baby and for your spouse. And when you chose not to, what you actually did was an act of self-betrayal. And then that starts you on a path that it happens very quickly and very subconsciously. So it's good to bring it out into the conscious. So what you do next is when you pretend to be asleep so that the spouse has to get the baby, now you come up with reasons to justify that self-betrayal. Well, I got up with the baby last night. Well, I had a really long day today. I've got a meeting first thing in the morning, and they don't. Right, and we build up these reasons, these excuses. Oh, it wasn't really self-betrayal. There were all these really good reasons why I did this thing, right? And we are very good at coming up with justifying reasons. We do it without even noticing that we do it. And then from there, but now there's still a little bit of guiltiness maybe about your spouse and that you put them in an awkward spot, even with a good reason. So then from there, what you do is you actually start to repeatedly justify, and then you actually distort your view of them and yourself. See, because you still might have a little bit of guilt lingering, so you have to say, and she should have known that I had a meeting in the morning, and she should have just gotten up in the first place. Or really, in the balance of things, I do so much more than they do. You know, whatever that is, like either I earn more, or I work more, or I do more chores around the house, or I always do this. And they should have just known. And you start to build with this repeated justification, you start to inflate their faults and inflate your own virtues. And you start to say to yourself over and again, you make them your enemy. Because it makes you feel better about not having been the one to get up with the baby in the first place. And when you do that enough times, you ultimately build this field around yourself of self-deception, where you no longer see yourself or others clearly. What you instead see is this inflated good version of yourself, and then this inflated bad version of them. And that field of self-deception that you live in, that box, is really powerful. Because now, if anyone has a criticism of you, if your spouse comes to you and says, boy, I really would love for you to help with the baby more, and you're already in your head thinking, but I'm the good spouse, you're the bad spouse, you're the unsensitive, uncaring one. And now when they tell you that, what might have been maybe a neutral comment or something where they're asking for help, now that's the bad spouse complaining when they already do less work than you do. And it's this great way to live because you are protected from any criticism, any judgment, any values of others, because you've already had to decide that they are not that great and you are. And it all started in this tiny little moment when you first acted in a way that you felt you shouldn't have, where you had a good, virtuous impulse that you, for whatever reason, didn't follow, and it sets you on this path until ultimately you're living in self-deception. And then what we do is we create these different boxes of self-deception in all of our areas of life. So over here, I'm a good husband, and I act these ways because I'm a good husband. Over here, I'm a good pastor, and I act these ways. And over there, I'm a good parent, and I act these ways. And all of them, we've built different stories, different rules, and it doesn't even really matter what the situation is, because all that matters is we have gotten ourselves trapped in this cycle of self-deception that we have to think of ourselves as the good person in that moment. And it's amazing the things that you can justify when you're living in this box of self-deception. See, because if you're a good person, then anything that you do must be the thing that a good person does, and you're going to come up with reasons why the values that you hold dear are the right ones and the best ones, and the values that maybe you don't hold so dear aren't. And suddenly you can be a worker at a workplace justifying, you know, all sorts of different things because you're a good worker. Obviously, you would act that way. Or you can be someone who acts one way at the gym and another way at church, and again, there's not a conflict there because you've got different boxes of self-deception at each place. And that long before anyone ever had an affair or robbed a bank or embezzled from their company, long before any of those big moments happened, this cycle had been going on in small ways all throughout their day, throughout their week, throughout their lives. And what this book says is every single one of us is doing this all the time. And the true thing to do is to be a person of integrity is to walk out of this cycle of self-deception. That's the way you find integrity in your life. And if we want integrity, this is what we've got to do. But it begs the question, if we're living stuck in self-deception, how would we ever know it? Because what happens is then we're judging by such a distorted standard that nothing's really going to get through. And so what I would say to that is we have to stop defining integrity as something that's based on some sort of external objective standards. When I was accepted to the Air Force Academy, I had to agree to a code, the honor code, and it said this, that I will neither lie, steal, or cheat, nor tolerate among us anyone who does. Which is a really great honor code as far as it goes, except that I don't really cheat or steal. Like, that actually just doesn't happen to me very often. I'm not put in those positions. And when I lie, it's always justified. Right? It's too small of a bar. It's too low. Like, okay, I don't cheat or steal. I'm fine. Or if we set the bar in the subjective standard of embezzling or having an affair or acting inappropriately or whatever, that's too high. By the time you've gotten there, you've already done so many damaging things along the way that it's too late. What I think is a far better way to evaluate and to really find and examine ourselves to see if we are a person of integrity or whether we are a person who has room for growth in this area is this question that I've started asking myself quite a lot. Here's the question. In given moments of conflict or stress or trying to understand and go through life, how much do I blame others? This has become the litmus test that really helps me identify where I've got areas to grow in integrity in my life. That if I'm coming home from a work day and my coworkers are all idiots and my boss is unfair and all of these things are wrong, it looks like I'm kind of blaming other people a lot. Or if I'm looking at my social relationships and everyone is isn't nice to me the way I want them to be, they don't live up to my standards of friendship, or my spouse isn't loving enough or appreciative enough, and I'm blaming others. And when I first read that book, and when I first started to ask this question of myself, I realized I blame so many people for the things that were wrong in my life. And that was a far better gauge of where I was in this path to integrity than any sort of objective moral standard. It was that when it came to these moments, I was so stuck in self-deception that I was a good guy, and I was thoughtful, and I was considerate, and I was blaming everybody for what was wrong in my life. And so if this is you, this is something to think about, or maybe even to ask, if you don't even trust your own perception, find someone you trust, someone you value, and just truly put this question in front of them. Hey, do you feel like I'm someone who blames others? And what I think you'll find is this is a much softer and gentler way to enter into this understanding of integrity than just some sort of a black and white moralistic, have you lived your life perfectly, keeping all your promises, doing the right thing? Just start here. And you're gonna find it so much more helpful. In fact, let's even think about that case study that we started with, the story of Naaman, and put yourself in the shoes of Gehazi. Think about, through this filter, how this story looked from his standpoint. Here's this foreign general, a guy that's actually fought battles against their country, a guy who has taken their people away in slavery, someone who has profited off of keeping Israel impoverished. And there was this line, you might have caught it, where Gehazi says to himself, you know, what is my master thinking, letting this Aramean off so lightly? He saw in Naaman someone that was to blame for so much of the difficulties in Israel. And then notice the excuse that Gehazi used to give to Naaman, that there were some brother prophets, co-workers of Gehazi's, who had need, that they were struggling to make ends meet, and could he please bless and help financially support these good, faithful, religious church workers? And you see how there's underneath that very lie, that excuse, there's resentment towards his own master, Elisha. He's thinking, Elisha, it's your job to provide for us, to take care of us. We gave up everything to be under prophets of yours. We trust you to take care of us and to guide us. And now here comes this foreigner offering wealth that would set up our little ministry for life. And you turned him down? And you see how Gehazi is blaming his master. He's blaming Naaman. He's blaming everybody except himself. See, long before his integrity was compromised by lying to his master, by lying to Naaman, it started when he deceived himself and started blaming the people around him for the problems in his life. Instead of facing the fact that maybe this wasn't actually the career that he wanted. Maybe he didn't want to be a religious worker living in poverty and always, you know, wondering where your next meal was going to come from. Maybe he needed to be in a different place. But he couldn't ask that question because he was stuck blaming others. And so this is the question that has been so valuable for me. It's helped me recognize when I'm starting to get a little outside of the integrity path and straying back into self-deception. I commend it to you. But to wrap this up today, where I want to really finish is with this amazing ancient wisdom that comes from Romans chapter 12. And if you've been here the last couple weeks, we're going to be spending all of our time in that chapter. And I strongly encourage you to be memorizing it. And if you haven't, then today's the day to start. We're going to be looking at the first three verses. And I want you to see with just some of the eyes and the perspective that maybe you've gotten over the last 25 minutes. And now look at what this is saying, not through some sort of biblical moralistic lens, but just look at what Paul is saying with direct vision, with clear-sighted eyes, all right? This is what Paul says in Romans chapter 12. He says, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy. This is his starting point. This is a chapter that's describing the virtues we all should be living. It's talking about empathy and self-control and integrity and all of the ways that we're supposed to live. But notice in verse 1 where it starts. It doesn't start with, since you're a good person, since you're perfect, since you're a person of integrity, right? It doesn't say any of those things. It says, in view of God's mercy. And just if you don't know what that means is you're a jerk and God loved you anyway. That's what that means. You self-betray yourself all the time and the people around you. But in view of God's mercy, This God who says, you screw up, you're broken, you're imperfect, I love you anyway. In fact, I even conquered death because of how much I love you. In view of all that, we have this response that we should offer our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God, that this actually becomes the true and proper act of worship. All right, he's not even talking about morality yet. He's just saying, hey, if God loves you enough to die for you before you got anything right, then there's an opportunity to live in a different way. And now, verse 2, he describes that a little bit. Here's what you should do. If God did this saving work in your name, and for his credit, not yours, then no longer conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Don't settle for the ethics of the world and what they say is right, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You see what virtue he's describing here? Integrity. He says, because then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. What's the right thing to do in the moment? You'll know it, because you've let your mind be transformed. What's the integrity way to act? You'll actually know what it is because you've let your mind be transformed in view of God's mercy for you. His sacrifice puts you on a new path. And then verse 3 is where he gets to what we've been talking about today. For by the grace given me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment, in accordance with the faith that God has distributed to each of you. See what he's saying? Walk out of self-deception. Don't think of yourself more highly than you're not. Don't build up these distorting narratives that you're better than other people, that your virtues are the good ones and their faults are worse than yours. He's saying, look at yourself honestly. And this is the picture of the path towards integrity that Paul gives us in the first 3 verses of Romans chapter 12. And now let's look at this through this lens of leadership and self-deception, see the steps that we can actually walk differently if verses 1, 2, and 3 are different for us. If we've been saved by God, by his worth, not our own. If we can, in fact, know the right thing to do in moments, and it comes by examining ourselves honestly. This is what we can do. See, here's the path back to integrity based on Romans chapter 12. And it starts the exact same way. I'd love to be able to tell you that the path to integrity starts with don't screw up. Just stop sinning. Stop hurting yourself and others. And then we'd be fine. We'd all live in integrity. That never is going to happen, not this side of death. That no matter how much God has done for us, we will always be in this life both saint and sinner. We're people who have been redeemed and called perfect, and yet we're still gonna act in imperfect ways. The way to have integrity, I think one of the reasons people fall off the horse so badly is because they lie to themselves and they think they can avoid this step. I'll just always act in a way that's consistent with my beliefs, and we never do. So the good news is you don't have to fix that step. You can start there. You can continue to be a broken person who's also redeemed by Christ. You can be a sinner and a saint, and you'll act in a way that you feel you shouldn't have. It's step 2 that you can change. Step 2, instead of in that moment trying to justify yourself, immediately admit what God already knows. I screwed up. I should have gotten up with the baby. I should have handled that interaction differently, and I didn't. And that's not their fault, it's my fault. And you own it. And what you'll find, if you actually do this, if you look in Scripture, if you talk to people that love you and value in your life, or religious mentors, people like that, what you'll find is what Scripture says, which is this, that when you do that, when you immediately admit it to yourself and to God, here's what you get. Immediate forgiveness and acceptance. Immediate. I think so much of the posturing of integrity is that we're so concerned about what other people think of us. And so we have to pretend to be perfect, and we have to tell this story to others that, no, I'm a good person, I'm perfect. But what God offers us is something so much powerful than that. Rather than being craven and hoping for other people's acceptance of us, God offers us divine acceptance. He says, look, I've already accepted you. Why do you let yourself get so bound up in what other people think of you? And if we can actually embrace God's acceptance, this divine saying that you're okay and you're valuable and you're worthy of love, then we can change the story. The story doesn't have to be that we're pretending to be perfect. The story can be God's perfect and I'm just trying my best. in any given moment. And that's actually an okay thing, because that's an integrated story. And that's the last thing we get, that's the way we end up with integrity, is that now our stories are all the same. And our stories don't have to be, I'm a good husband who acts certain ways over here, and I'm a good pastor who acts different ways over here, and I'm a good parent who acts different ways over here, and a good worker who acts different ways over here. It can all be the same story. I'm doing my best. But the integrity that I rely on, the perfection I rely on, is not my own. It's that of a God who has shown me his mercy all the days of my life. And if we do that, then all of our stories are integrated. We don't have to try to pretend anymore. It's the thing that lets me stand up here in front of you and tell you all about the ways that I'm not the parent I would like to be all the time. I'm not the pastor I'd like to be all the time. I'm not the husband I'd like to be all the time. I can tell you those because my story has been integrated. And my integrity now comes not from my being perfect and having my act together. It comes from my willingness to lean on the goodness of God. That I'm up here before you just like you are, doing my best, messing up sometimes, getting it right sometimes, but what I've stopped doing is lying to myself. I've stopped pretending that I'm something I'm not. And by that route of self-evaluation and honesty that Paul describes in 12:3, which you should memorize, that says, I look at myself with sober evaluation, that's the thing that gets me out of the moralistic, shaming trap of integrity. See, true integrity, it's not about perfection. It's not about blaming or shaming people into keeping all the many promises and obligations that we have on us. Integrity comes from throwing ourselves at the cross of Christ, admitting that he's the perfect one when we're not, and being willing to live a life of transparent honesty where all of our stories are integrated and they're one, where we're not the main character living a life of heroism and virtue and perfection. We are side characters in God's story, recipients of his grace and goodness, people that are just trying our best, and we don't have to be ashamed to admit that. Would you pray with me about that? Lord God, as we come before you and we look at your word today, remove from us this false burden that we've put on ourselves, this idea that we have to be the ones to live these lives of perfection, and that if we screw up, we're done. Lord, give us a new story. A story that says you have done all of the saving, all of the fixing, all of the healing, and that we can live authentically, transparently, in light of that grace. That we can stand before a broken world and share in their brokenness, but also share in the hope that comes from knowing that you have given us your divine acceptance. You have said we are worthy, and we no longer have to pretend to be anything that we're not. Lord, fill us with your spirit. Help that to be true in each and every one of our hearts. We pray this in your holy name. Amen.